Lincoln, Disc 14.
Lincoln couldn't openly campaign for the nomination because tradition dictated that the office should seek the man, and he necessarily worked through aides and intermediaries, many of them veterans from his 1858 senatorial race. In Springfield, he continued to rely on Hatch, the Illinois Secretary of State, and Dubois, the state auditor, whose offices made them privy to detailed, confidential political information about every part of the state. In the Chicago area, Wentworth offered to be Lincoln's Warwick, but he turned instead to Judd. He didn't entirely trust Judd, but recognized his power as chairman of the Illinois Republican State Central Committee and as the Illinois member of the Republican National Committee. Both Leonard Swett and Richard Yates, who were competing with Judd for the Republican gubernatorial nomination, served as Lincoln's agents in central Illinois. Gustav Korner, the Belleville lawyer, was his principal connection to the German-American constituency, which he also tried to reach through Dr. Theodore Canisius, whose newspaper, the Springfield, Illinois Staatsanzeiger, he secretly owned. His most trusted advisor, however, was Judge David Davis, who emerged as his informal campaign manager. "I keep no secrets from him," Lincoln declared. These Lincoln managers weren't an organized or unified group. Throughout Lincoln's career, his advisors felt connected only to him, not to each other or to some larger cause. Indeed, their loyalty to Lincoln was matched in many cases by the distrust they exhibited toward each other. Davis never forgave Judd's role in defeating Lincoln's election to the Senate in 1855. Judd hated Wentworth. Wentworth attacked not merely Judd, but Hatch and Dubois. Swett and Yates were rivals united only by their dislike of Judd. Of course, Lincoln was aware of this dissonance, but he tolerated it. Perhaps he believed that advisers in competition with each other would work all the harder. One result of this decentralized command structure was that each member of the group came to think that he, and he alone, truly understood Lincoln and gave him useful advice. Curiously enough, many of Lincoln's advisers viewed him as a man who needed to be encouraged and protected. Even those who played only minor roles in the Republican Party often shared this attitude. For instance, Nathan M. Knapp, chairman of the Scott County, Illinois Republican Party, believed that Lincoln was a greater man than he himself realized. "He hasn't known his own power. Uneducated in youth, he's always been doubtful whether he wasn't pushing himself into positions to which he was unequal." David Davis put it another way. "Lincoln has few of the qualities of a politician and can't do much personally to advance his interests because he was such a guileless man." Had Lincoln known of this pronouncement, he might have been amused. While his managers were hard at work, Lincoln had to appear above the fray. To requests for his views on the political scene, he replied that he was not the fittest person to answer such questions because when not a very great man begins to be mentioned for a very great position, his head is very likely to be a little turned. Nevertheless, he managed to offer opinions that, without being barbed or invidious, cast doubts on the availability of the other prominently mentioned candidates. Seward, he declared, is the very best candidate we could have for the north of Illinois, and the very worst for the south of it. The same held for Chase, except that he's a newer man. Bates would be the best man for the south of our state and the worst for the north of it. The strongest candidate, he asserted with apparent lack of guile, was Justice John McLean, aged 75, if only he were 15 or even 10 years younger. Even with avowed supporters, Lincoln was cagey. When James F. Babcock, editor of the New Haven Palladium, who'd been much impressed by the speeches Lincoln made in the recent Connecticut campaign, offered to promote his candidacy, he replied in unusually opaque language, "As to the presidential nomination, claiming no greater exemption from selfishness than is common, I still feel that my whole aspiration should be, and therefore must be, to be placed anywhere or nowhere as may appear most likely to advance our cause." Nevertheless, he passed along to Babcock a list of 11 confidential friends who were working for his nomination. When one enterprising Illinois Republican suggested that he ought to have a campaign chest of $10,000, Lincoln replied that the proposal was an impossibility. "I couldn't raise $10,000 if it would save me from the fate of John Brown. Nor have my friends, so far as I know, yet reached the point of staking any money on my chances of success." To a request for money from Mark W. Delahaye, an old and somewhat disreputable Illinois friend who hoped to be a delegate to the Republican National Convention in order to promote his chance of being elected senator from Kansas, Lincoln responded, "I can't enter the ring on the money basis, first, because in the main, it's wrong, and secondly, I haven't and cannot get the money." Yet, admitting that in a political contest the use of some money is both right and indispensable, he offered to furnish Delahaye $100 for his expenses in attending the convention. As it turned out, Delahaye wasn't chosen as a Kansas delegate, but went to Chicago anyhow to root for Lincoln, who paid him the money he'd promised. Central to Lincoln's planning was Douglas's expected role in the coming campaign. If the Democratic National Convention, scheduled to meet in Charleston, South Carolina, on April 23rd, nominated the Little Giant, the Republicans would be obliged to choose a candidate from the West, where Douglas was enormously popular. On the other hand, if the Democrats nominated a Southern rights champion, like Vice President John C. Breckinridge of Kentucky, or if the party split, Republicans would feel free to nominate Seward, Chase, or any other anti-slavery leader. Thus, as had so often been the case, Lincoln's prospects varied directly with Douglas's. Given this political reality, Lincoln adopted a very simple campaign strategy. He hoped to go into the Republican National Convention with the unanimous support of the Illinois delegation, and perhaps with the backing of a few individuals in other delegations. If Seward failed to secure the nomination on the first ballot, a decision that would be determined in no small part by what happened to Douglas, Lincoln and other candidates would have their chance on a second ballot. Recognizing that most members of the convention would favor someone else, Lincoln thought that his great strength lay in the fact that no one made any positive objection to him. "My name is new in the field, and I suppose I'm not the first choice of a very great many," he explained to Samuel Galloway. "Our policy, then, is to give no offense to others. Leave 'em in a mood to come to us if they shall be compelled to give up their first love." The first step was to secure the unanimous support of the Illinois delegation. This wasn't an easy task, because both the Sewardites in northern Illinois and the Bates men in the south favored selecting delegates by districts, thus, as Judd said, hoping to steal in a few men. Alerted that the votes of Yates and the other members of the Central Committee from Central Illinois would determine this question, Lincoln promised, "I shall attend to it as well as I know how, which, God knows, will not be very well." In fact, he attended to it well enough, for the Central Committee voted for the statewide election of delegates. It was equally important to have the Republican National Convention meet in Chicago, where the newspapers, the crowds, and the publicity would be heavily tilted in Lincoln's favor. The rival site was St. Louis, where the Bates influence would be strong. When Judd, as a member of the Republican National Committee, seemed slow to grasp the importance of this choice, Lincoln wrote him that "some of our friends here thought the location of the convention of great consequence." With this prodding, Judd carried the case for Chicago to the meeting of the National Committee, which chose the Windy City by a margin of one vote, his own. Even more important was the action of the Illinois Republican State Convention, which met at Decatur on May 9th and 10th, a week before the National Convention. To house the gathering, the citizens of the town had followed a practice adapted by Republicans throughout the West, and constructed what they called a wigwam, a barn-like wooden structure capable of holding the hundreds of delegates and spectators. For many who attended, the principal business of this convention was the choice of a candidate for governor. Eventually, the supporters of Sweatt and Yates combined to defeat Judd and to give the nomination to Yates. As to presidential candidates, Illinois Republicans were divided, but it was generally recognized that the convention would give a complimentary endorsement of Lincoln as a favorite son. Even David Davis thought it was a foregone conclusion that the National Convention would choose either Bates or Seward. A first ballot vote for Lincoln would simply be a compliment. But a few of Lincoln's warmest supporters were determined to make the Decatur Convention a launching pad for a serious presidential campaign. They felt that what had been lacking so far was a catchy slogan, like "Log Cabin and Hard Cider," which had done so much to elect President Harrison in 1840. Of course, Lincoln was already widely known as Old Abe or Honest Abe, but these sobriquets seemed so colorless as to be almost negative. Richard J. Oglesby, a vigorous young Decatur politician, felt Lincoln needed a more dynamic image. Consulting with the elderly John Hanks, a first cousin of Lincoln's mother, he located a rail fence that Hanks and Lincoln had put up in 1830 and carried two of the rails home with him. On the first day of the convention, during an interruption in the voting for governor, Oglesby introduced Hanks, who, with an assistant, marched down the aisle carrying into the wigwam the two rails labeled "Abraham Lincoln, the rail candidate for president in 1860. Two rails from a lot of 3,000 made in 1830 by Thomas Hanks and Abe Lincoln, whose father was the first pioneer of Macon County. The label wasn't entirely accurate, for Lincoln's father had not been the first pioneer in the county, And it was John, rather than Thomas Hanks, who had helped split the rails, but nobody cared. As the rails, decorated with flags and streamers, were carried to the front of the wigwam, the crowd burst into deafening applause. Lincoln called to the stand, blushed, and told the delegates that he had indeed built a cabin and split rails 30 years ago near Decatur. Whether these particular rails were taken from that fence, he couldn't vouch. But, he said in his disarming way, he'd mauled many and many better ones since he'd grown to manhood. The cheers that greeted Lincoln's remarks suggested that even his managers had underestimated his popularity. Now labeled the Rail Splitter, just as Andrew Jackson had been Old Hickory and Harrison Tippecanoe, he acquired an image with enormous popular appeal. He could be packaged not merely as a powerful advocate of the free soil ideology, or as a folksy, unpretentious storytelling campaigner, but also as the embodiment of the self-made man, the representative of free labor, and the spokesman of the Great West. It mattered very little that this myth, like most myths, was only partially true. Lincoln, in fact, had little love for his pioneer origins. He disliked physical labor and left it as soon as he could. He owed his early advancement as much to the efforts of interested friends like John Todd Stewart, Stephen T. Logan, and David Davis as to his own exertions. Rather than a simple backwoodsman, he was a prominent and successful attorney, representing the most powerful interests in emerging corporate America. The delegates at Decatur understood that myth was more important than reality. They cheered now not just for a favorite son, but for a viable Illinois presidential candidate. After the convention adjourned for the day, Lincoln met with Judd, Davis, and a few other friends in a grove near the wigwam, where, lying on the grass, they carefully studied the list of delegates to be sent to Chicago. Lincoln personally selected the 4 at-large delegates. Judd, as a member of the Republican National Committee, and as a representative of Chicago interests, was one, of course. Recognizing the importance of the German vote, Lincoln named Corner for the 2nd slot. For the 3rd, he picked Browning, who had great influence among conservative old-line Whigs, and, especially, among the former Know-Nothings. Knowing that Browning preferred Bates, Lincoln relied on his old friend's personal loyalty and his devotion to Illinois interests. The final member of the team was David Davis. Lincoln and his friends had no control over the selection of the 18 other delegates who represented the individual congressional districts, but they suspected that about 8 of them were Seward supporters. To prevent them from defecting, Lincoln's advisers agreed to ram through the convention the next day a resolution that John M. Palmer would introduce, that Abraham Lincoln is the choice of the Republican Party of Illinois for the presidency, and the delegates from this state are instructed to use all honorable means to secure his nomination by the Chicago Convention and to vote as a unit for him. At Chicago, Illinois would be unanimous for Lincoln. Lincoln was tempted to attend the Chicago Convention. After he returned from Decatur, he told Leonard Swett that he was almost too much of a candidate to go and not quite enough to stay at home. On reflection, he decided to remain in Springfield while the delegates began to assemble. He cordially greeted the occasional member who passed through Springfield, assuring several of them that he was a candidate only for the presidency and didn't wish to be considered for the second place on the Republican ticket. Recognizing that Seward would have the votes of the more extreme anti-slavery men, Lincoln sought to ensure that he'd be presented in Chicago as a moderate candidate. To Edward L. Baker, editor of the Illinois State Journal, who was going to the convention, he entrusted a brief note. "I agree with Seward in his irrepressible conflict, but I don't endorse his higher law doctrine." The former he viewed as little more than a restatement of his own house-divided thesis. While he recognized that Seward's invocation of a law higher than the Constitution frightened moderate and conservative Republicans. Lincoln wasn't directly involved in the tumultuous proceedings of the Second Republican National Convention that assembled on May 16th through 18th in the huge wigwam just completed in Chicago. The Illinois delegation took no prominent part in the first day's debates on the credentials of members, nor did it attempt to shape the party platform, which somewhat moderated the tone, though not the meaning, of the 1856 denunciation of the slave power. Illinois Republicans went along with the party's attempt to broaden its appeal by endorsing a Homestead Act to please Western farmers, federal appropriations for improving rivers and harbors to satisfy Detroit, Chicago, and other cities on the Great Lakes, and, in opaque language, a moderately protective tariff to appease the iron interests of Pennsylvania and New Jersey. With much difficulty, they agreed on a compromise resolution that, on the one hand, carefully refrained from mentioning, much less condemning, the Know-Nothings, and, on the other, cautiously opposed the Massachusetts plan of extending the period before naturalized citizens could vote. It ended with a balanced call for giving a full and efficient protection to the rights of all classes of citizens, whether native or naturalized, both at home and abroad. The focus of Lincoln's representatives in Chicago wasn't on the platform, but on the presidency. They found Seward's position stronger than they'd anticipated because the Democratic National Convention, deadlocked between Douglas's backers and the Southern states' rights advocates, had adjourned without making a nomination. Already assured of the support of what might be called Greater New England, the states of the Upper North, ranging from Massachusetts through New York to Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota, Seward might win if the Democrats continued to deny the nomination to Douglas, their strongest candidate in the North. But realistic Republicans anticipated that when the Democratic National Convention reconvened in June, Douglas would be the nominee, with formidable strength in the Ohio Valley region, including Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and Kentucky. Seward's rivals were further encouraged when the new National Union Party, more or less a reincarnation of the Whig and American parties, on May 10th, nominated John Bell of Tennessee and Edward Everett of Massachusetts. Seward couldn't compete with this ticket for votes in the Upper South. Unless Seward came into the convention with great strength on the first ballot, Republican managers were bound to pause and look for a more available nominee. the shrewdest Republicans at Chicago were looking for a candidate who, in addition to carrying all the northern states that had gone for Fremont in 1856, could win in Pennsylvania, Indiana, and Illinois. Seward, for all his strength elsewhere, was weak in these states. Chase had the support of only a part of his own Ohio delegation. Cameron had no following outside of Pennsylvania. Despite the vigorous backing of Greeley and the powerful Francis Preston Blair family in Maryland and Missouri, Bates probably couldn't carry even his own home state. That left Lincoln. He wasn't a dark horse, that is, a nominee unexpectedly chosen after a deadlock of the leading candidates, but from the first day of the convention, a serious contender backed by the unanimous delegation from the critical state of Illinois. Though he wasn't widely known except in the West, he appeared to be exactly what the Republican Party needed. He was unequivocally opposed to the expansion of slavery. He had for years favored economic development, including internal improvements and the protective tariff so dear to Pennsylvanians. He had strong emotional appeal to former Whigs, who still considered themselves followers of Henry Clay, and he'd managed to oppose the Know-Nothing Party without indulging in moral condemnation of the nativists. If the Republican delegates at Chicago followed the dictates of political reason, he would be their choice. But of course, Lincoln knew that emotion plays as large a role in politics as reason. And that's why he wanted his team of managers in place at Chicago. Ready to provide information, squelch rumors, listen to complaints, give moral support, soothe ruffled egos, and flatter doubting delegates. From his rooms at the Tremont Hotel, David Davis took charge of the operation. His primary objective was to secure at least 100 votes for Lincoln on the first ballot, more than any other candidate except Seward, with other votes in reserve so that Lincoln would appear to gain strength on a second ballot. For this purpose, he sent out members of his team to talk with delegations where they might have influence. Sweat, for instance, visited the delegation from Maine, the state of his birth, and S.C. Parks canvassed those from his native state of Vermont. Browning proved invaluable in talking with delegations that teetered between supporting Bates and Lincoln. Known as a former Bates man, he was the better able to show the weaknesses of the Missouri candidate. Logan kept an eye on the Kentucky delegates. He carried a private letter from Lincoln authorizing him to withdraw his name if he thought it prudent to do so. Medill was in charge of newspaper publicity for Lincoln, and, aided by C.H. Ray, he kept up a barrage of pro-Lincoln editorials in the influential Chicago Press and Tribune, beginning with a 3-foot editorial headed "The Winning Man, Abraham Lincoln," on the day before the convention came to order. Judd, in charge of seating arrangements in the wigwam, took pains to put the New York delegation at one end of the hall and the Pennsylvania delegation at the other. Separated by pro-Lincoln supporters, they couldn't confer or influence each other during the balloting. Aware that Thurlow Weed, commandant of the Seward forces, had come to Chicago on a special 13-car train filled with the New York senator's supporters, Judd also arranged for Illinois railroads to offer special rates so that thousands of Lincoln men could attend the convention. After the first day, when it seemed likely that Seward men would pack the wigwam, Jesse W. Fell and Ward Hill Lehman oversaw the printing of duplicate tickets and made sure they went to Lincoln men who'd come early and occupy the seats before the Seward backers arrived. Inevitably, there was talk at this convention, as at all political conventions, of horse trading between candidates and of promising undecided or unscrupulous delegates future patronage, or sometimes immediate cash, for their votes. Weed was prepared to make deals in Chicago, just as he had long done in Albany. He dangled before the Illinois delegates a promise of the vice presidential nomination for Lincoln if they supported Seward on the first ballot, and also offered to contribute $100,000 to the campaign chests of the Illinois and Indiana Republican parties. Some of Lincoln's supporters wanted to play the same game. "You need a few trusty friends here to say words for you that may be necessary to be said," Ray warned Lincoln as the convention was assembling. "A pledge or two may be necessary when the pinch comes." Delahaye, the Kansas Republican, whose expenses in Chicago Lincoln was paying, had a similar idea. He wrote the candidate that Davis, Dubois, and the other members of his team were too honest to advance your prospects as surely as I would like to see, and too innocent to compete with New York politicians who were desperate gamblers. Lincoln ought to pick one representative from Pennsylvania, Ohio, Massachusetts, and Iowa, and promise each full control over all patronage in his state if he delivered the vote of his delegation. "I know that you have no relish for such a game," Delahaye continued, "but it's an old maxim that you must fight the devil with fire." In response to such suggestions, Lincoln sent a terse message to Chicago: "Make no contracts that will bind me." For the most part, his directive was unnecessary. Though Davis's team had been working incessantly to woo uncommitted delegates, they didn't find it necessary to resort to bribery or corruption. Subsequent stories about the numerous bargains Davis and his aides made in Chicago were mostly based on speculation by ill-informed politicians who'd been surprised by the showing Lincoln made at the convention. For instance, the charge that Davis promised a cabinet post to Caleb B. Smith in order to secure the vote of the Indiana delegation on the first ballot had no foundation. Before the convention met, a delegate from Vincennes, Indiana, alerted Lincoln that the whole of Indiana might not be difficult to get, and at his instruction, Davis and Dubois paid special attention to the Indiana delegation in Chicago. Indiana Republicans were looking for an alternative to Seward because Henry S. Lane, their candidate for governor, felt that he had no chance for success if the New Yorker headed the ticket. Some favored Bates, who appealed to the old Whigs, but others supported Lincoln. At a caucus of the delegation, Bates's managers tried to woo the Hoosiers, but they were routed when Corner reminded the delegates that German Republicans from nearly every northern state, meeting at the Deutsches Haus in Chicago on May 14th, had agreed to bolt the party before supporting any candidate, like Bates, who had a nativist record. The Indiana delegation then agreed to vote unanimously for Lincoln on the first ballot. No special pledge was needed to gain Smith's support. After serving with Lincoln in Congress and working with him to elect Zachary Taylor, he was proud to be chosen to second Lincoln's nomination in Chicago. There was more credibility to the report that Davis made a bargain with the Pennsylvania delegation, offering a cabinet post to Simon Cameron if his supporters went for Lincoln after the initial ballot. Judge Joseph Casey, Cameron's representative in Chicago, demanded that Davis and Swett pledge that Cameron would become Secretary of the Treasury in Lincoln's cabinet, with control of all federal patronage in Pennsylvania, in return for the votes of that state on the second ballot. Davis responded vaguely that Pennsylvania would surely have a place in the cabinet, and that he would personally recommend Cameron for it. Assuming Davis was authorized to speak for Lincoln, Casey thought he'd received a pledge, and shortly after the convention wrote Cameron that the switch of Pennsylvania votes to Lincoln was arranged carefully and unconditionally in reference to yourself, to our satisfaction. But Swett, who was present at the conference between Davis and the Pennsylvanian, came away with a different understanding and told a friend, in a private letter, written only 9 days after the convention, "No pledges have been made, no mortgages executed." Davis himself, believing he'd made only a personal, conditional promise, flatly denied any bargain. "Mr. Lincoln is committed to no one on earth in relation to office. He promised nothing to gain his nomination and has promised nothing." That also was Lincoln's understanding when, 3 days after his nomination, he assured Joshua R. Giddings, "The responsible position assigned me comes without conditions, save only such honorable ones as are fairly implied." While the Republican National Convention was in session, Lincoln went quietly about his business in Springfield. But he eagerly sought to learn what was going on in Chicago. Up early on Friday, May 18th, the day when nominations were to be made, he passed some time playing fives, a variety of handball, with some other men in a vacant lot next to the Illinois State Journal office. Learning that James C. Conkling had unexpectedly returned from Chicago, he went over to his law office to hear the latest news from the convention. Stretched out on an old settee, so short that his feet stuck out over the end, he listened to Conkling's prediction that Seward couldn't be nominated, and that the convention would choose Lincoln. Lincoln demurred, unwilling to tempt fate by being over-optimistic, and said that either Bates or Chase would probably be the choice. Getting up, he announced, "Well, Conkling, I believe I'll go back to my office and practice law." At the Lincoln and Herndon office, Baker of the Illinois State Journal came in with telegrams announcing that the names of the candidates had been placed in nomination and that Lincoln's was received with great enthusiasm. Shortly afterward, a new telegram announced the result of the first ballot. Seward, 173.5, Lincoln, 102, Bates, 48, Cameron, 50.5, Chase, 49. The other votes were widely scattered. 233 were needed for a choice. Giving no indication of his feelings, Lincoln went over to the telegraph office, where a report on the second ballot was just coming in. Seward now had 184.5 votes. Lincoln, largely as a result of a switch in the Pennsylvania vote, rose to 181 votes, and all the other candidates lost strength. Lincoln then awaited the results of the third ballot in the Journal office. As he'd anticipated, this was the last ballot. Seward retained most of his strength, but nearly all the other delegates flocked to Lincoln, with a total of 231.5 votes, 1.5 votes short of a majority. At this point, David C. Carter rose to switch 4 Ohio votes from Chase to Lincoln, and other delegations promptly followed, giving him a total of 364 out of a possible 466 votes. The Seward men then moved to make the nomination unanimous. "I knew this would come when I saw the second ballot," Lincoln remarked as he accepted the congratulations of his fellow townsmen. Emerging from the Journal office, he said jokingly to the ball players, who broke off their game to congratulate him, "Gentlemen, you'd better come up and shake my hand while you can. Honors elevate some men." Then he headed home, explaining, "Well, gentlemen, there's a little woman at our house who's probably more interested in this dispatch than I am." When the news of his nomination became official, along with a report that the convention had balanced the ticket by naming a former Democrat, Hannibal Hamlin of Maine, for vice president, Lincoln felt under some pressure to go to Chicago, where he could bask in his triumph, allow the Republican delegates a chance to meet their candidate, and soothe the disgruntled Seward element in the party. But his advisers unanimously urged him to stay in Springfield. "Don't come here, for God's sake," Davis wired succinctly, adding, "Write no letters and make no promises till you see me." That was the policy that Lincoln followed. On May 19th, a delegation from the convention, headed by George Ashman of Massachusetts, came to his house in Springfield to notify him of his nomination. Initially, the interview was very stiff. Only a few of the delegates had ever seen their candidate before, and they were startled by his appearance. Lincoln was tense because he and Mary had just had a quarrel over whether liquor should be served to the visitors, as it certainly would have been at her father's mansion in Kentucky. But Lincoln knew the strength of the temperance movement and insisted on offering only ice water. As he explained a little later, "Having kept house 16 years and having never held the cup to the lips of my friends then, my judgment was that I shouldn't, in my new position, change my habit in this respect." After Ashman read the notice of his nomination, he responded cautiously that he needed more time fully to consider the platform, and in fact didn't formally accept until 4 days later. To keep the meeting from being a fiasco, Lincoln resorted to a gambit he was frequently to employ in the White House. Singling out the lanky Pennsylvania delegate, William D. Kelly, he asked how tall he was. 6'3" was the answer. "I beat you," chuckled Lincoln. "I'm 6'4" without my high-heeled boots." "Pennsylvania bows to Illinois," Kelly responded in a courtly fashion. "I am glad that we have found a candidate for the presidency whom we can look up to." As the visitors began to relax, they moved into the adjoining parlor to meet Mrs. Lincoln. She was such a charming conversationalist, in the Southern style, that Ashman reported, "I shall be proud, as an American citizen, when the day brings her to grace the White House." Most of Lincoln's encounters in the months between his nomination and the election were equally content-free. Now that he was a celebrity, everybody wanted to see him, and the number of visitors became too great to be handled at the house on 8th and Jackson Streets, especially after Willie fell ill with scarlet fever. Gladly, Lincoln accepted the invitation of Governor John Wood to use his office in the state capitol. He worked there daily during the summer. Nicolay, who was paid $75 a month from a fund contributed by 10 of Lincoln's wealthy Springfield friends, served as his secretary and assistant. Most of Lincoln's correspondence was of the usual but necessary inconsequential sort expected of public men. He had to make gracious acknowledgment of the hundreds of letters of congratulations he received. There were so many applications for autographs that he prepared a standard reply. "You request an autograph, and here it is. Yours truly, A. Lincoln." He had politely to acknowledge election as honorary member of the Washington Agricultural Literary Society of the Farm School in Pennsylvania, later Pennsylvania State College, and to accept a chair of state made of 34 different kinds of wood, each representing a state of the Union. Knox College, which had been the home of one of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, conferred on him the LLD degree, with the implication, as Browning joked, that he should thereafter consider yourself a scholar as well as a gentleman, and deport yourself accordingly. Much of Lincoln's time was occupied in attempting to satisfy the enormous public curiosity about a candidate whose career wasn't widely known outside his own state. There was uncertainty about his first name, and he had to assure even Ashman that he was Abraham rather than Abram. Photographers flocked to Springfield to take his picture. The most successful was Alexander Hessler of Chicago, whose sharply defined prints gave, as Lincoln said, a very fair representation of my homely face. They showed Lincoln at the height of his powers and captured, as no other photographs ever did, the peculiar curve of his lower lip, the mole on his right cheek, and the distinctive way he held his head. But most photographers found it hard to take a good picture of the candidate whose face in repose showed such harsh lines that it looked like a mask, and their cameras couldn't catch the light that flashed in his eyes and the smile that animated his face when he was conversing or telling a story. Several artists also came to Springfield to paint his portrait, and Lincoln uncomplainingly sat for them. To combat the general impression in the East that Lincoln was a very ugly man, Judge John M. Reed of Pennsylvania commissioned John Henry Brown to paint a miniature that would be good-looking whether the original would justify it or not. The distinguished artist, Thomas Hicks, completed a romantic portrait which Lincoln said would give the people of the East a correct idea of how I look at home. I think the picture has a somewhat pleasanter expression than I usually have, but that perhaps is not an objection. Along with Lincoln's portrait, people clamored for facts about his life. Requests for biographical information became so numerous that Lincoln drafted a form reply for Nicolay to send out. Applications of this class are so numerous that it's simply impossible for him to attend to them. Hardly was the Chicago Convention over before campaign biographies of Lincoln and Hamlin were announced. Probably the earliest to be published was the anonymous Life, Speeches, and Public Services of Abraham Lincoln, together with a sketch of the life of Hannibal Hamlin, issued in The Wigwam Edition by Rudd and Carlton in New York by June 2nd. Others quickly followed. The most significant, because of its authorship, was by William Dean Howells, which relied in considerable part on interviews that his research assistants, James Quay Howard, conducted in Springfield. Howard himself published another biography. Of greater lasting merit was A Life of Lincoln by John Locke Scripps, an editor of the Chicago Press and Tribune, which was based on an extensive autobiographical sketch that Lincoln gave him. In all, perhaps 100,000 to 200,000 of such campaign biographies were distributed. Part of Lincoln's time was spent in attempting damage control of rumors about his record. Opponents whispered that he was a deist and a dualist. Stories of his stand on the Mexican War were resurrected, with charges that he failed to vote for supplies to the American army in the field. He was charged with slandering the memory of Thomas Jefferson by accusing him of puling about liberty, equality, and the degrading curse of slavery while selling off his own children into slavery. A report surfaced that Lincoln had attended a Know-Nothing Lodge in Quincy. All these Lincoln painstakingly refuted in private letters, cautioning his correspondents not to get him involved in controversy. "Our adversaries think they can gain a point if they could force me to openly deny this charge," he explained to one. "For this reason, it must not publicly appear that I am paying any attention to the charge." Forbidden by the unanimous advice of his friends from taking any public role in the canvass, Lincoln followed the campaign closely. After June, when the Democratic Party split, with the northern wing of the party nominating Douglas and the southerners nominating John C. Breckinridge, he had little doubt that the Republicans would win the presidential election if the discordant and rival elements that composed the party could work together. He spent much time attempting to conciliate the rival factions in Pennsylvania, headed by Senator Cameron and Andrew G. Curtin, the Republican candidate for governor. Because that state was so crucial, he tried to impress on both the soundness of his record on the tariff, going so far as to send a collection of snippets from his addresses during the 1840s showing that he favored protection. Aware that Seward's followers were disgruntled because of his defeat in Chicago, Lincoln sent word to New Yorkers through David Davis that he neither is nor will be committed to any man, clique, or faction, and that it will be his pleasure to deal fairly with all. Again and again, he pledged that if elected, his slogan would be justice and fairness to all. In welcoming visitors to Springfield, and in writing letters, he firmly refused to make any distinction between Republicans who had supported his candidacy before Chicago and those who had favored other candidates. "I go not back of the convention," he explained to Carl Schurz, who'd backed Seward, "to make distinctions among its members. You distinguish between yourself and my original friends," he told Schuyler Colfax, the glib young Indiana politician who'd supported Bates. "That was a distinction which, by your leave, I propose to forget." Despite all the visitors and all the correspondence, Lincoln found life as a presidential candidate confining. He rarely went to the law office these days, and when Herndon dropped in on his partner in the state capitol, he found his partner bored badly, and exclaimed to Trumbull, "Good gracious, I wouldn't have his place and be bored as he is." Lincoln's one public appearance during the campaign was at a giant rally in Springfield in August, where he expected simply to see the people and to allow himself to be seen. Entreated to address the crowd, he reiterated his policy. "It's been my purpose, since I've been placed in my present position, to make no speeches." So enthusiastic was his reception that, when he got ready to leave, the crowd at the fairgrounds surrounded his carriage, broke through the top, and came near to smothering him. He escaped only when a friend backed his horse next to the carriage, pulled Lincoln out, slipped him over the horse's tail onto the saddle, and led the horse to town. Occasionally, Lincoln thought of taking a more active role in the campaign, imitating Douglas, who was flouting precedent and making stump speeches in behalf of his candidacy. When Seward, who recovered from his momentary peak, went on a barnstorming tour of the West for the Republican ticket, Lincoln momentarily thought of going to Chicago to meet him. But friends persuaded him that he mustn't appear to be following the chariot wheels of the senator's triumphant procession. He remained at home, but when Seward passed through Springfield, the two men had a brief chat. Restive, Lincoln even considered, improbably enough, accepting an invitation to speak at a horse show in Springfield, Massachusetts, perhaps because the trip would allow him to visit Robert, who had just been admitted to Harvard College. But his friends convinced him that such a trip would be viewed as evidence of Republican alarm, and he dropped the idea. Necessarily, then, Lincoln was largely isolated from the hurly-burly of the campaign. He had little to do with the gigantic rallies Republicans held in most northern cities, with the innumerable processions of young Republican wideawakes, clad in black oilcloth capes and caps, bearing rails surmounted by torches. He could only watch the exhibitions put on by Republican paramilitary groups, like the Zouave Company recruited and drilled by his young friend Elmer Ellsworth, who was supposed to be reading law in the Lincoln and Herndon office. Such parades and shows and monster meetings, Lincoln confessed, were not much to his liking anyway. It was the dry and irksome labor of organizing precincts and getting out the voters that determined elections. Impatiently, Lincoln awaited the returns from the October state elections, especially in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Indiana. The news of Republican victories in all three states confirmed the brilliance of the party campaign strategy. The returns, which would be closely paralleled in the general election a month later, showed that the Republicans, by disavowing immigration restrictions, had succeeded in holding on to a fair share of the foreign-born vote, especially among younger Protestant voters. More important, they demonstrated that in nominating Lincoln, who'd taken pains not to attack the Know-Nothings publicly, the party was able to win most of the voters who'd supported Fillmore in 1856. And finally, they proved that despite Lincoln's personal lack of interest, the wide-awake clubs, with their frequent meetings, organized drills and processions, stimulated immense enthusiasm on the part of younger voters, many of whom cast their first ballots in this election. It was appropriate for the victory to be celebrated by a parade of the Springfield wide-awakes to Lincoln's house, where, standing on the doorstep surrounded by friends, he bowed silent acknowledgment of their applause. The next day he wrote Seward, "It now really looks as if the government is about to fall into our hands. Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Indiana have surpassed all expectation." Now, all that was needed was to avoid any missteps during the remaining weeks before the general election on November 6th. Silence was his best policy, because any new statement or restatement of his views would lead to new misrepresentations by opponents. To one worried advisor, he gave assurance, "Allow me to beg that you'll not live in much apprehension of my precipitating a letter upon the public." On election day, Herndon went to Lincoln's office in the state capitol and urged his partner to vote. Initially reluctant, Lincoln was persuaded that his ballot might be important in the state elections, and he cut off the top of the sheet, listing the presidential electors, so that he would not be voting for himself. Then, accompanied by Herndon, and escorted on one side by Lehman and on the other by Ellsworth, he went to the polls. Republicans yelled and shouted as he approached, and again after he cast his ballot. Even Democrats, who were proud of their local celebrity, respectfully raised their hats. That evening, Lincoln joined fellow Republicans who crowded the Capitol to hear the returns, relayed from the telegraph office. Illinois went Republican, then Indiana, and then the ticket did well in the other western states. But there was still no news from the critical eastern states, and Lincoln, Dubois, Hatch, and one or two others walked over to the telegraph office. Not until after 10 o'clock did reports come in of Republican victories in Pennsylvania. While they were awaiting the news from New York, the party was invited to Watson's Saloon, where the Republican ladies, who'd taken it over for the night, were serving supper. When Lincoln entered the room, the women greeted him. "How do you do, Mr. President?" After eating, Lincoln stayed on at the telegraph office until about 2 o'clock, when the news that his party had carried New York made his election certain. "I went home, but not to get much sleep," he remembered, "for I then felt, as I never had before, the responsibility that was upon me." It was days before the exact measure of his victory could be determined. When the final tally was made, the Republican ticket received 1,866,452 votes to 1,376,957 for Douglas, 849,781 for Breckinridge, and 588,879 for Bell. With less than 40% of the popular vote, the Lincoln and Hamlin ticket won 180 votes in the Electoral College to 72 for Breckinridge, 39 for Bell, and 12 for Douglas. The Republican ticket carried all but one of the free states and divided that one, New Jersey, with Douglas. Douglas, despite his large popular vote, won only the Missouri and part of the New Jersey electoral vote. Bell's strength was in the states of the Upper South, Virginia, Tennessee, and Kentucky. Breckinridge won in all the other slave states. It was ominous that Lincoln and Hamlin received not a single vote in 10 of the southern states. In the days before the election, as Republican victory seemed increasingly likely, Lincoln's basic pessimism reemerged as he began fully to realize that a campaign, initially undertaken primarily for local political reasons, was going to place him in the White House. Just a few days before the election, he remarked to a New York caller, "I declare to you this morning, General, that for personal considerations, I'd rather have a full term in the Senate, a place in which I'd feel more consciously able to discharge the duties required, and where there's more chance to make a reputation and less danger of losing it than 4 years of the presidency." Chapter 10. An Accidental Instrument. Formidable problems faced the president-elect. At the news of his election, disunion erupted in the South. On November 10th, the South Carolina legislature unanimously authorized the election of a state convention on December 6th to consider future relations between the state and the Union. 8 days later, Georgia followed suit. Within a month, every state of the Lower South had taken initial steps toward secession. Northerners were divided over how to deal with the crisis. Some few thought the dissatisfied states should be allowed, even encouraged, to go in peace. A much larger number favored a new agreement in the spirit of the Missouri Compromise and the Compromise of 1850 that would keep the southern states in the Union. At least as many others opposed any concessions to the South. The United States government had no policy to deal with this crisis. President James Buchanan was torn between his belief that secession was unconstitutional and his conviction that nothing could be done to prevent it. The lame duck Congress was controlled by the recently formed Republican Party, a still imperfect fusion of former Whigs, former Democrats, and former members of the American Party. With experience only as an opposition party, Republicans had never before been called on to offer constructive leadership. All eyes now turned to Springfield, where an inexperienced leader with a limited personal acquaintance among members of his own party, groped his way, on the basis of inadequate information, to formulate a policy for his new administration. In the months after the election, the president-elect went steadily about his business in Springfield. Working with Nicolay, his efficient, unflappable private secretary, he dealt with several baskets of mail that arrived each day. Presently, the burden of correspondence was so great that Nicolay recruited young John Hay, a recent graduate of Brown University who was studying law in his uncle's office in Springfield, to help. Letters requesting Lincoln's autograph were the easiest to answer. Dozens of letters of congratulation and many more requesting jobs went promptly into the wastebasket. Still, much correspondence required the attention of the president-elect himself. At 10 o'clock, Lincoln opened his office in the state capitol to visitors, and they flocked in until he closed at noon, only to return for his afternoon hours from 3 to 5:30. His callers were of every sort, politicians offering advice on policy and cabinet assignments, journalists looking for exclusive stories, or at least local color, artists who wanted to paint his picture, women who simply asked to shake his hand, country bumpkins who came to gawk, old friends from his New Salem days. The room was always crowded. It could comfortably accommodate only about a dozen people. But Lincoln wanted to see everybody. Spying a delegation waiting in the hall, he'd reach out to shake the leader's hand and insist, "Get in, all of you." Asking for their names, he'd start a conversation and seemed never at a loss for words. Visitors didn't know what to make of this president-elect. He surprised even his old friends by growing a beard. During the campaign, some New York true Republicans, worried that Lincoln's unflattering photographs would cost the party votes, suggested that he would be much improved in appearance provided you would cultivate whiskers and wear standing collars. A letter from an 11-year-old girl in Westfield, New York, named Grace Bedell, promised to get her brothers to vote for Lincoln if he let his beard grow. "You would look a great deal better, for your face is so thin," she suggested. All the ladies like whiskers, and they would tease their husbands to vote for you, and then you would be president. Amused, Lincoln replied, "As to the whiskers, having never worn any, do you not think people would call it a piece of silly affectation if I were to begin it now?" He answered his own question, and by the end of November was sporting a half beard, which he initially kept closely cropped. No one knew just what to make of the change. Perhaps it suggested he was hiding his face because he knew he wasn't ready to be president. Or maybe it demonstrated the supreme self-confidence of a man who was willing to risk the inevitable ridicule and unavoidable puns like "Old Abe is putting on hairs." Or possibly it hinted that the president-elect wanted to present a new face to the public, a more authoritative and elderly bearded visage. Or maybe the beard signified nothing more than that the president-elect was bored during the long months of inaction between his nomination and his inauguration. Lincoln's manner as well as his appearance startled visitors. Though he was often called Old Abe, he was, up to this point, one of the youngest presidents of the United States. Only 51 years old, he was a generation younger than his predecessor, James Buchanan. Vigorous and athletic, he loped along in his countryman's gait at a pace that tired out companions 20 years younger. And he bounded up stairways 2 or 3 steps at a time. His energy seemed inexhaustible. So did his conversation. Visitors to his office often felt stunned by the sheer volume of his words. He showered upon them opinions, ideas, and anecdotes concerning almost every subject in the world, except secession, on which he closely kept his own counsel. What puzzled the most was his highly unpresidential habit of regaling guests with jokes and anecdotes. When telling these tales, his face lit up, and at the punchline, his high-pitched laughter rang through the Capitol. He might punctuate a story with a hearty slap on his thigh, and after a particularly good one, he would rock with mirth, sometimes reaching out with his long arms to draw his knees up almost to his face. Lincoln liked puns. The more outrageous, the better. He enjoyed Irish bulls, like the story of Patrick and his new boots. "I shall never get 'em on," said the Irishman, "till I wear 'em a day or two and stretch 'em a little." He delighted in tall tales, especially those with a frontier setting in Kentucky or Indiana. Most stories he recounted simply because he thought they were funny. Laughing along with his visitors helped break the ice. But he also knew how to use storytelling to deflect criticism, to avoid giving an answer to a difficult question, and to get rid of a persistent interviewer. When former Governor Charles S. Moorhead of Kentucky urged him to make concessions to the secessionists, Lincoln was reminded of Aesop's fable about the lion in love with a beautiful woman, whose parents were opposed to her marrying the beast, but were afraid of his long claws and sharp teeth. Claiming that their daughter was frail and delicate, they asked the lion to have his claws cut off and his tusks drawn, lest he do serious injury to her. Desperately in love, the lion consented. And as soon as his claws were clipped and his tusks removed, the parents took clubs and knocked him on the head. Disgruntled, Moorhead remarked that it was an exceedingly interesting anecdote, and very apropos, but not altogether a satisfactory answer. Lincoln used this technique throughout his presidency, to the bafflement of those who had no sense of humor, and the rage of those who failed to get a straight answer from him.
This ends Disc 14.